From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. The intense national debate over how to respond to the group Islamic State hit home again this week when the group made a show of killing another journalist with Granite State ties. And what the U.S. should do has become an issue in the primary elections. Here's 1st Congressional District GOP candidate Dan Innes.
My strategy would be to wipe ISIS off the face of the earth quickly and firmly and make sure they never come back. We can do it with our air power and the ground forces of Syria and Iraq.
In the 2nd District, candidates called for caution, including Republican Gary Lambert, who himself served in Iraq.
Let me be very clear, no boots on the ground. I'm the only person on the stage that was boots on the ground in Iraq. So I was one of those boots. No more boots on the ground. It's time for the Iraqis to take their own destiny and run with it.
Islamic State was also prominent in last night's U.S. Senate primary debate, with Republicans calling President Obama's response weak. But speaking at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard this week, Vice President Joe Biden gave an aggressive speech saying America would follow the terrorists to the gates of hell.
America may be grieving, still grieving, from Jim Foley, a native of New Hampshire, as I said, who grew up in Rochester. But the American people are so much stronger, so much more resolved than any enemy can fully understand.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you. We're going to start with foreign policy emerging as a major issue in the midterm. So let's get your take on that story first. Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for the roundup this week include Kathleen Ronayne. She's State House reporter for the Concord Monitor. Kathleen, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Josh Rogers, senior political reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio. Josh, thanks for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Good morning, Laura.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, good to see you as always.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, we're going to spend a lot of time, folks, this hour talking about the primary debates this week held on WMUR. And Josh and Kathleen, you participated in some of those. Josh, to you first, what's the big takeaway from this week of debates on the Republican side?
Well, I'm not sure any of these debates really change the fundamental dynamics of these races. As you mentioned, the killings by ISIS, brought international issues and, other things going on in the world more to the fore. I mean, a lot of these races have been waged by Republicans, sort of against Obamacare and the health law. And this has changed the focus a bit and, sort of up the ante all, down the line. And I think that's one reason why Joe Biden was here to sort of rally Democrats a bit and, talk tough. But, these debates were interesting and, it's worth remembering that, it's hard to know how many people are going to vote in a primary. Turnout tends to be low, tends to be people who are engaged. But still, for a lot of people who will be voting Tuesday, these debates may have been, a first or a major opportunity to get to see these candidates. So for the candidates, there was a lot riding on them.
Sure. And throughout the hour, we'll be playing little clips from the debates so folks can get a sense of these candidates, who they are, what they're talking about. To you, Dean Spiliotis, this switch from sort of healthcare and the economy, those were the issues, 6 months ago. Now we're talking a lot about foreign policy, not only this group Islamic State, but also Vladimir Putin and what he's doing in Ukraine. Almost seems like a flip from 2008. Remember way back when going into the election, at first it was all about Iraq and then the economy emerged. Now it's kind of the reverse.
That's right. And it's often the case. In fact, it's usually the case that foreign policy crises or the types of circumstances we've seen over the last month or so, and in particular with the two recent murders of the journalists, really focuses attention both at the presidential level but also Congress as well. And even members of the House of Representatives, foreign policy is part of their portfolio. It was an opportunity for us to kind of revisit some of the big decisions on Iraq and Afghanistan, how to deal with the terrorist threat across a number of different countries, Syria, Libya as well. So I was not surprised to see that. I think it's important to hear what these candidates think. They're all going to have, at the congressional level, they're all going to have an impact on decision making. So I thought it was good to see. You know, we hear so much about Obamacare and immigration and other issues. It was interesting to see them have to really think through these foreign policy concerns.
Well, and immigration has become also a big issue in some of these Republican primaries, especially Kathleen Ronayne, the second congressional district debate, which you covered. Now, why is this a big issue, especially for the second CD?
Gary Lambert has been consistently hitting Mary Linda Garcia, saying that she favors amnesty. He's pointing to a resolution of the National Conference of Hispanic State Legislatures that she signed that talked about the benefits of legal status for people who are already here. So it's become his point of attack. I mean, in any type of Republican primary where there's not that much of a difference between the candidates, they need to find a way to differentiate themselves from each other. So Lambert has really consistently been hitting her on that. We have Garcia hitting back and saying she doesn't favor amnesty. She never has. We've seen it up on the airwaves. So I think it's an issue right now that they see as popular with the Republican base, speaking out against amnesty, speaking for securing the border. So Lambert's trying to find a way to create a wedge between himself and Garcia on the issue.
Well, let's hear a little bit from that debate. Again, these are the three main candidates for the second congressional district Republican nomination. We're going to hear from Gary Lambert, Mary Linda Garcia, and Jim Lawrence.
My record is clear, and actually Representative Garcia's record is clear. She wants a pathway to citizenship. And that is amnesty in my book.
We have to have legal status, which allows us to know who they are and what they're doing and put them on a process of reform, which includes reforming the pathway to citizenship.
The policy that Australia now has is that if you come there illegally, you'll never get to stay. I want America to adopt that same policy.
Again, candidates for the second congressional district in New Hampshire, Republican candidates in the primary, which, by the way, is next Tuesday. We're talking about the series of Republican primary debates held this week. Getting your thoughts as well, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dean Spiliotis, the words we keep hearing in this immigration debate, amnesty, pathway to citizenship. What's the message there?
Right. And I'll touch on that in a moment. But first, it's important to note that the issue of immigration has taken on added urgency, particularly among conservatives. If you listen to them, they argue that, a number of American citizens who are fighting as part of ISIS over in Syria and Iraq have American U.S. passports, or maybe they have European passports. They would then have access into our country, or they can come in illegally through our southern border. So the immigration issue, citizenship, amnesty, et cetera, has now been kind of folded in to the foreign policy crisis of dealing with terrorism. So it's not only an economic issue, it's now a national security issue as well. So it's very important. You know, as for kind of the issues of amnesty, the back and forth between Mary Linda Garcia and Gary Lambert, she's making an argument about, sometimes there's confusion between giving people legal status versus giving them citizenship and amnesty. She's talking about some intermediate step where you could at least identify who the undocumented workers are. We should note that she's going to have Ted Cruz coming in on Sunday in Nashua to rally with her, basically gives her conservative credibility on immigration. I think that will be very helpful for her.
Again, the number here in the exchange for you to join our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And all of you, let's go to our listeners. Pat's calling from Chichester. Hi, Pat. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
As a combat vet retiree myself, one thing that really disturbs me about all the candidates running right now for the national office is nobody has really come out and said that it is their responsibility as members of Congress to, if we are going to engage ISIS in a bigger war, to actually declare that war. You know, it's the responsibility of the president to approach Congress and explain why he wants to go to war. And then Congress needs to do that. And that would involve implementing a war tax to cover both the cost of the deployment as well as the cost of fixing the broken people we have that come back.
So people need to be more upfront about the costs and so forth, Pat. That seems to be what you're saying.
We need to be upfront, but we also need to be we need to be very diligent about following the Constitution. We have not declared war since World War II.
Okay. Pat, just jumping in there. Sorry, Pat, to interrupt you. But, Josh, I did want to ask you, since you covered the 1st Congressional District and the U.S. Senate debate, how are these candidates kind of threading the needle between, you know, extreme concern over what this group is doing in the Middle East, but also, you know, we don't want to get involved in another Iraq? I sort of heard candidates talking about both of those issues.
Well, in the Senate debate last night, it was interesting in that Scott Brown said, you know, we can't take any options off the table. That would include sending ground troops. Bob Smith, meanwhile, said, you know, folks have been fighting in that region since the death of Muhammad. Like, you know, we've been inconsistent and we don't need to get back in there. Jim Rubin said, you know, to send troops in there would be starting a third Iraq war. And, you know, sort of running through, you know, both parties, but sort of, you know, more compellingly in the Republican Party is, you know, tensions between, you know, hawks and people who are more isolationist. And, you know, obviously circumstances out there, you know, may force people to make tough decisions. But, you know, you heard Gary Lambert saying we don't need to send troops in there. And, you know, this debate isn't going anywhere fast. And, you know, certainly to Pat's point, you know, it's true that the U.S., you know, the commander in chief has been given a pretty free hand to, you know, deploy troops without, you know, following what a lot of people would consider the correct process through the years. Like, I don't expect that to change.
So we did hear some caution from these candidates this week.
Certainly.
Yeah. Do you want to jump in, Kathleen, from the 2nd Congressional District standpoint?
Yeah. I mean, in the 2nd Congressional District, we did hear, you know, when asked, Gary Lambert said no boots on the ground. I think that all three of the candidates said that we need to be careful about how we engage. But in that race, they definitely have not been talking about it as forcefully as the U.S. Senate candidates have. I mean, Scott Brown's been making this kind of a centerpiece of his campaign, foreign policy, calling out the president, calling out Jeanne Shaheen, saying they're not doing enough, whereas that's not really been an issue that's dominating the 2nd Congressional District race. And I think it's probably because it is a bit of a tricky issue for Republicans. You know, do you want to appear hawkish? Do you want to appear careful to get into war? So I think that they haven't been engaging on that issue quite as much in that race.
Well, Pat, thank you very much for the call. And coming up, we'll be talking about a couple other issues that emerged in these debates, including gun legislation and the economy, also health care. We'll take more of your questions and comments, too. So keep it right here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're covering some of the big stories that made headlines in the Granite State this week. And this week in particular, given that there is a primary election on Tuesday, we're covering what happened with those primary races this week. There was a series of debates on WMUR. We've been talking about what was said at those debates, playing back for you a little bit of sound from what the candidates were saying. You can join us now with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. If you watched any of these primary debates, what impressions did you walk away with? What do you think about some of the statements that were made on the issues, from immigration to terrorism to gun policy? Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. A couple other matters, folks, that came up in these debates. One of them, Dean Spiliotis, was the economy. Again, in January, a lot of people thought this would be the big issue along with healthcare. That has changed, as we've said. What jumped out at you, Dean, from these debates on this issue of how these candidates would hope to improve the economy?
Well, it's interesting because whenever I've now seen these candidates several times in debates, and they're always kind of presented with current economic circumstances, rate of growth of the economy, number of jobs, et cetera. There was one question in the debates that sort of laid this all out and asked the candidates to respond to why the economy is not doing well. You know, we keep coming back to a couple of core issues with all of the Republican candidates, really. One is an opposition to raising the minimum wage, and in fact, for a number of the candidates, an opposition to any sort of federal minimum wage at all. They see it as stifling economic growth and innovation of companies. So the minimum wage, a lot of talk about the way in which the Obamacare mandates are affecting companies negatively. And then thirdly, talk about debt and deficit and the impact of the debt. So, you know, the sort of fairly traditional, you know, economic positions. We've talked many times in recent months about the issues of, income inequality and job equity. These are big Democratic themes. We're going to hear about them in the general election. And I think the Republican candidates in general, with some differences, were very clear that raising the minimum wage, is not the answer, and repealing some of the mandates of Obamacare is the answer.
Well, and let's hear what some of the first congressional district candidates had to say about the economy. This is in response to your question, actually, Josh Rogers, of has the economy gotten better since 2009? We're going to hear in order Frank Ginta, Brendan Kelly, and Dan Innes.
No, Josh, I don't think it is. Carol Shea Porter has served in this seat multiple times over multiple years, and she hasn't done anything to try to improve the economic conditions of middle-class Americans or middle-class families here in New Hampshire.
I mean, all the people who are out of work are still out of work, so I don't know how you can say that the economy is all of a sudden better if the people are not working.
Well, the economy is clearly not better, and when you look at the areas that are growing, it's not really strong growth. I'm a business owner, so I'm living this.
Again, those are the three candidates for the first congressional district on the Republican side, Frank Ginta, Brendan Kelly, and Dan Innes. And Josh Rogers, so there you had three different takes on that question. Frank Ginta kind of running a general election campaign, right? Not even really addressing the question, but just saying Carol Shea Porter hasn't done anything.
Yes, and it's not surprising, and, you know, it's election season, and so, you know, certainly one can have honest disagreements about, you know, the state of the economy, and, you know, it's a complicated topic. It's unsurprising that people in a party that's out of office are going to say the economy is bad. This is going to be something that, you know, we're going to be hearing a lot, though, during the, you know, some of the issues that Dean brought up. Democrats have made a lot and think that they can sort of rally their base by focusing on income inequality, the minimum wage, you know, Republicans, fewer regulations, lower taxes, you know, pretty standard fare.
And you were at that first district debate,
yes.
Right, Josh? What else jumped out at you from that debate between these three gentlemen?
Well, you know, I guess generally speaking, you know, Frank Ginta, who's the best known candidate, didn't do himself any harm in the debate, really. This was an opportunity for Dan Innes, who has, you know, run a reasonably strong campaign for a first-time candidate, does have some, you know, doesn't have a long track record in state GOP politics, and, you know, has voted in Democratic primaries in the past, made financial contributions to Democrats. This has been something that's worried the Republican base. He did okay, but it's not like he really did anything that would dislodge Ginta as the seeming frontrunner. And, you know, Brendan Kelly, he ran as a Libertarian last time, not terribly well-known, hasn't really been out there. You know, he's not going to be a huge factor here. But if the election is tight, you know, a small bit of votes for Mr. Kelly could make a difference.
Right, because midterm elections, the numbers, Dean, are small. And so, you know, a couple thousand here, a couple thousand there could change things.
Well, in the composition of the electorate, are you going to get kind of hardcore conservative activists, or are you going to get, you know, maybe some more independents who have maybe taken an interest in Scott Brown and are going to show up at the polls? That could have an impact on turnout as well.
Again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. By the way, while we're talking about the economy, news just came out that U.S. job growth slipped a little bit in August, only 142,000 jobs added. This just came out. Although unemployment fell slightly to 6.1%. This, again, is from the unemployment reports that the federal government puts out the first Friday of every month. So since we're talking about the economy, I thought I would mention that. You can join us again at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. All of you, I want to ask also about health care. And as we said earlier in the year, it seemed like these elections would be dominated by the Affordable Care Act. Has that happened, Kathleen? Where is health care in the range of issues that are being talked about?
Yeah, I think that we're going to see healthcare probably start to emerge a little bit more once we get into general election mode, because
sure.
Scott Brown came out of the gate criticizing Jean Shaheen on her support for the Affordable Care Act. We've seen that message get hijacked a little bit by things like immigration and foreign policy. But I think, you know, in a Republican primary, there's usually pretty broad agreement that people don't like the Affordable Care Act. So I think we're going to see that issue starting to emerge again once a Republican wins the primary in each race and they are facing a Democrat. They're probably going to start talking about it a little bit more. In the second congressional district, we have seen Gary Lambert trying to create a little bit of a wedge between himself and Marilinda Garcia again on this issue. He has a new ad out saying that she supports Obamacare mandates. If you talk to her, she doesn't support Obamacare. She's never supported Obamacare. So that message is not really on point. But he's taking comments she made, I think, to the Keene Sentinel, that there are provisions of Obamacare, such as letting people stay on their parents' insurance till they're 26, that she does support. So she's,
those are good ideas, but she doesn't necessarily support as they stand in the legislation.
Yeah, and she's always been – I mean, she's always talked about Obamacare and wanting to get rid of it, change it, not have that kind of what she calls a, you know, federal takeover of your health care. Anytime she's asked about the economy in the debate, you know, she usually pivots to Obamacare and how these mandates are hurting people, hurting businesses. So we are hearing the candidates talk about it, but I think that it's going to become more of a divisive issue once it's Republican versus Democrat, not three Republicans.
No, it makes
together.
Sense because they pretty much see this from the same lens. Josh, you want to jump in? And then I have another question for you, Dean.
I mean, and the second CD is an interesting example of this. I mean, another thing Gary Lambert's doing is he's seizing upon Marilinda Garcia's absence during a vote on Medicaid expansion and trying to exploit that. But one thing that was interesting in listening to them talk about that issue is that I think Garcia said something to the effect of, you know, plausibly we're not going to get rid of it at once. What we need to do is hack away at it and then ultimately replace it. You know, Lambert, meanwhile, was much more stridently like, we're going to repeal it. And, you know, at the same time later in the debate when the question came up of like, would you support an impeachment against the president? He's like, well, you're not going to send me down there to do something that you can't be done. And that's not going to happen. So, you know, there was a bit of an inconsistency there because the same, you know, political realities would apply to that as, you know, with the president there and with control of the Senate unclear. But in the Senate debate, it was interesting to hear them talk about that. Rubens and Smith, you know, basically like, you know, hell no. Brown, obviously his political career has in some way been based around an opposition to, you know, Obamacare running against it. But as Smith said, you know, you supported so-called Romney Care in Massachusetts, or Smith referred to it Obamacare Jr.
And the
individual mandate and, you know, forcing people to buy insurance. And so, you know, this issue is a complicated one. And, you know, certainly polling indicates that, you know, Americans may be becoming more satisfied with it. So, you know, how much this, shockingly, politicians are often driven by polls and what they're campaigning on. So, you know, we'll see down the stretch.
Well, it was interesting to hear Bob Smith call it Obamacare Jr. And Scott Brown's response, correct me if I'm wrong, Josh, please, has always been on this issue. The states should come up with their own plans.
Yes. And, you know, how credible that, like, conservative voters find that, you know, that's a Federalist argument. But, he that's what he says.
Yeah. And some candidates saying, no, that's not enough. Repeal the whole thing. Dean, I want to go back to what Kathleen said about some of the advertising,
sure.
Especially in that second congressional district. A couple questions. First of all, how unusual is it to have this level of advertising for a Republican primary in a congressional district? I mean, we're not even in the general election yet.
That's true. I think increasingly this is going to become the norm. We've talked about this many times. I think the way in which the campaign finance process has changed through various court decisions in recent years, the ability of outside advocacy groups to organize and get involved in states using technology, social media, the ability to do ad buys, there's just a lot more money out there. You know, Republicans view this as a big midterm year for them. It's an opportunity to pick up seats in the House, take the Senate back. So I'm not surprised to see this kind of money being spent. It is quite remarkable. I know I watched like an hour of news last night, and literally every commercial break is, you know, Marilinda Garcia is too liberal, and then the next commercial is Gary Lambert is too liberal. And it's just it's quite remarkable. But sadly, for people who don't like this stuff, I don't see this lessening anytime soon. And I think there is a sense that that Republicans view this particular seat, the second CD, as being a vulnerable seat. So they're going to pump resources into it. I think if let's say, for instance, if Marilinda Garcia wins the primary, given the kind of support she's already getting from the National Party, you're going to see a ton of money pour into that second CD because Annie Custer has, I think, $4 or $5 million already. So it's going to be an expensive race.
Yeah. Go ahead, Kathleen.
Yeah, I mean, while we're on the topic of advertising, I think it's a good time to talk about how much bad blood has really developed between Garcia and Lambert in this race. And I think, you know, we saw it after the debate when she didn't shake his hand. And it might seem like a silly thing to talk about, but I think the volume of, you know, if she wins, the volume of negative advertising against her is only going to increase. And if she's at the point right now where she can't shake Gary Lambert's hand for, you know, three negative ads that he's run against her, I think, I mean, you know, voters can take that how they will. But I think that it raises some questions about, is she going to be able to withstand the type of criticism and hammering that she is going to get if she wins this primary election? Because if she thinks this is bad, I mean, it's not even close to what is going to be coming for her in terms of negative advertising and negative messages if she makes it to the general election.
Again, our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup as we wrap up some of the primary debates that we saw on WMUR this week in New Hampshire, given that there is a primary election in New Hampshire on Tuesday. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. One more big issue that jumped out for me from these debates, and Josh Rogers, I'll turn to you first because this was your question last night at the U.S. Senate debate. This was in terms of gun legislation and the often repeated charge that Scott Brown is weak on Second Amendment rights. Give us a little sense of what's going on there.
The specific question was about the assault weapons ban, which was in place for in the U.S. for 10 years. And post Newtown, Scott Brown come out and said, you know, I would support this again. He'd supported a weapons ban as a Massachusetts state senator. You know, the question is why did you say that? And, you know, he didn't give a terribly direct answer. And then, you know, Smith and Rubens had at him.
All right. Let's hear what happened.
In Massachusetts, we took a vote that, in fact, allowed for an extension of an assault weapons ban that was already in place. And here's the difference. It was done, actually, with everybody at the table. We had pro and anti-gun advocates at the signing ceremony.
Well, there he goes again. I mean, the answer, you didn't get the answer to the question. He goes on and on. He's got terrible ratings with all of the gun organizations. He's not pro-gun. He's just not pro-gun. And the answer is, it's very frustrating. Answer the question. I'm not going to support a ban. I'll tell you that right up front.
You cannot slither around the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution. It is not to be compromised under any circumstance. I have an A rating, both from my voting record in the state Senate and from both Go New Hampshire and NRA.
Again, those are the candidates for the U.S. Senate Republican nomination. In order, Scott Brown, Bob Smith, and Jim Rubens. Dean Spiliotis, yeah. Your thoughts there?
Yeah, this is actually important for a number of reasons, not only for people who are interested in gun rights, but it raised a clear distinction in the debate last night and I think in the campaign in general. You know, Scott Brown used the assault weapons ban as an example of how he would conduct himself and has conducted himself as a U.S. senator, that his door is always open, bipartisanship is important, you have to work across the aisle to get anything done. Jim Rubens and Bob Smith were very clear. No, it's all about conservative principle. I've heard Bob Smith say a number of times, it's us against them. We win, they lose. Two very different styles here. Now, you could say Scott Brown, you know, has his eye on the general election and the need to attract independents and moderates, but he didn't back away from that. So, you know, what Jim Rubens is calling slithering, Scott Brown is calling, you know, being open to working across the aisle. You know, Brown's been in the military for many years. He's a gun owner. You know, but people have different gradations of how they feel about that issue. But the bigger issue is, yeah, gun rights is an important part of the debate. But the bigger issue is this fundamental difference in how they view conducting themselves in office.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, too. And Josh, to you first and then Kathleen. Often in primaries, Republican candidates, you know, veer right and then they tack to the middle in the general election. That's, you know, been tried and true for candidates of both parties for a long time. But there was Scott Brown last night on the stage really striking a lot of bipartisan tones, even though he's in a primary debate.
Well, I mean, his record is his record. And you know, he says he has said, I'm going to essentially conduct myself the same way as I did in Massachusetts. I'm, you know, as he says, I'm a 50-50 guy. I vote with both sides. I'm an independent voice. He says that a great deal. You may have noticed. And it is interesting to the extent that, I mean, part of it is like, you know, it may be totally reflective of his beliefs. It may be a political reality that, you know, you can't really run away from your record. And it may also be that, you know, he's looking to the general election. And
he thinks he's got this sewed up, so why not look ahead
now? And that to win a general election, you know, Bob Smith would differ with this. A lot of Republicans think, you know, a more moderate candidate stands a better chance of winning. You know, Bob Smith last night afterwards said, you know, we're not going to win if we don't stick with our principles. You know, the voters obviously will decide that.
Yeah, and one more interesting thing, speaking about the general election, there was a question towards the end of the debate, Josh, last night, who among Democrats do you admire? And Scott Brown said, Jean Shaheen. I was kind of stunned by that.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, he did say he had worked with her, and he said, you know, she's wrong on the issues. And, you know, it's probably not a bad idea in terms of if you're going to try to pry, you know, independent voters who may have voted with Shaheen historically, who may be disenchanted with the president, to think like, okay, well, this is somebody who's going to do something a little different, and he's not, you know, talking down Jean Shaheen, and, you know, certainly in some of his in his run against Elizabeth Warren, it got a little bitter, and, you know, there is a gender gap that favors Democrats, and to the extent that Scott Brown can pull in female voters in particular, that would be bad news for Jean Shaheen and Democrats.
Yeah, Kathleen.
I mean, I guess just on that point of who Scott Brown respects. I hate to sound cynical, but I wonder how many New Hampshire Democrats Scott Brown really knows enough to, you know, be able to say that he respects them.
Given
whereas,
how new he is to the state.
Whereas Jim Rubens and Bob Smith had, you know, Democrats in New Hampshire that they had worked with on things in the past. But I did notice, I can't remember what it was in response to, but at one point Scott Brown said, I've bucked the party before and I'll do it again. Or he said something like that. And that's not a primary message. That's a general election. Message of him saying, you know, I'm willing to go against my party. Jean Shaheen vote, you know, he'll keep saying votes with President Obama 99% of the time. So I thought that was surprising that came out of his mouth on a primary stage.
All right. We will talk more after a short break. We'll turn our attention to the governor's race. The GOP candidates in that contest have their debate tonight. So we'll give you a little preview. Also, a couple other environmental issues that have come up recently. We'll cover those as well. You can join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup at 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today, and you can join us as we cover some of the top stories of the week. This week, we're especially focusing on the upcoming primary elections on Tuesday, all the action on the Republican side, including a series of debates on WMUR this week. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And all of you, let's go back to our listeners. Peter's in Danville. Hi, Peter. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead. Oh, we lost Peter. Peter, I hope you call back. The number 1-800-892-6477. Again, email exchange@nhpr.org. Well, folks, we talked a lot about the debates this week for the first and second congressional districts and that big U.S. Senate primary debate. The gubernatorial Republican candidates are debating tonight. And Dean Spiliotis, just remind us what the dynamic of this race is.
Well, you have Walt Havenstein, former BAE Systems CEO. You have Andrew Hemingway, who's been a conservative activist in the party for a number of years, somewhat younger than Mr. Havenstein. He's sort of viewed kind of more as kind of a Tea Party style candidate, kind of involved with the conservative base of the party. There has not been a lot of love lost between these two individuals. It's gotten increasingly nasty. They both essentially accusing each other of kind of a lack of business ethics and or acumen. You know, with Havenstein, there's been a lot of discussion about the fraud investigation at one of the companies he headed up. With Hemingway, there's been a lot of discussion about his business practices and lack of business filings that are required by law. You know, Havenstein has kind of lined up the establishment. He's had Chris Christie in from the Republican Governors Association to campaign for him. He's got Kelly Ayotte. He's got Mitt Romney. Certainly going to have a lot more money in a general election. Andrew Hemingway has spent most of his time trying to point out that he thinks Havenstein is not really a true conservative. Again, it's this issue of kind of differing leadership styles and differing views of how the office should be carried out. So
different wings of the party,
yeah, different wings
generations,
of the, yeah, just everything, right? And I think we're going to because it's only two people tonight, I believe, it'll be a very interesting back and forth.
Right, absolutely. Josh, to you and then Kathleen.
Well, Walt Havenstein, establishment Republicans, you know, were eager to get him into this race. I think part of the reason is that he has the ability to largely self-fund his race, which he has, to the tune of about $1.5 million. And, you know, they thought, okay, businessman with a record, military background, no voting record, manager, you know, kind of Republican John Lynch kind of thing. And, you know, it would help the ticket to have somebody there who, you know, could be a reasonable candidate. You know, he hasn't been overwhelming on the stump. you know, and it's tough to dislodge a governor after one term. It simply doesn't happen very often. And in that Governor Hassan did work with Republicans on the budget. They did cut a deal on Medicaid expansion. It sort of doesn't give Havenstein a huge amount to work with. And, you know, Hemingway, meanwhile, has been out there with, you know, the base of the party for a while. And it is true that, you know, he's sort of a mercurial figure, young man in a hurry. I mean, he managed Newt Gingrich's campaign. I mean, Havenstein is, I think he's 66. Hemingway is 33. I mean, there's a big difference. The visuals will be quite different. You see them on stage tonight. It's been interesting to listen to them, but this hasn't been a race that people have been paying attention to, even though traditionally the governor's race is really what produces the coattails.
Sure. It's tough, though. You're right, Josh, because, you know, typically New Hampshire does give a sitting governor a second term. So it's a tough job for those folks. Did you want to jump in, Kathleen, real quickly, and then we'll go back to our listeners?
Yeah, I think this is an important night for Andrew Hemingway, because while he does have a long history with the Republican base, people that are very passionately on his team and will do the work for him, will come out to vote. Beyond that base, he hasn't – I mean, a lot of people still don't know who he is. He hasn't gone up on TV. Havenstein's done 2 television ads, which I think, you know, is really helpful in getting your name out there. So I think that this is really Hemingway's chance to have a lot of people watching him, to show people who he is, to show people that he is, you know, a viable option against Havenstein. And I think that this is important for him. I think that he really needs to shine tonight if he – wants to attempt to make any kind of difference in the outcome of this election.
Let's go back to our listeners. And Peter is back from Danville. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange, the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup.
Hi. Thank you. Look, my organization endorsed Brendan Kelly, but I'm commenting first and quickly on apparent bias during the debate. I watched carefully, and Mr. Kelly was passed over 3 times. It was very apparent. And I thought he was treated with some sort of a condescending attitude, like he was lucky to be there, you know. But he's a very credible candidate. On another thing, because I'm an economist, a quick comment on the what was said here on the program and also during the campaign about jobs. You know, the government doesn't create jobs. Entrepreneurs do. And I think there should be more attention paid to how governments do what they can do in this area, which is create an environment which facilitates rather than impedes entrepreneurship.
Sure.
So that's loss of job creation.
I think we did hear the candidates saying that.
Any comments back? Thank you.
Yeah, Peter, and thank you for calling in, and thanks for trying back. I know we lost you the first time around. I think, Dean, these Republican candidates did echo what Peter is saying. Look, government doesn't create jobs. It facilitates, as Peter put it.
Right. You know, this has been kind of the core of the Republican critique against Democrats is that, you know, they've accused the Obama administration of seeing kind of government as kind of the primary driver in terms of creating jobs and economic opportunity rather than kind of facilitating and staying somewhat out of the way so that the private sector can function for sure. You know, as for the issue surrounding Mr. Kelly and whether or not he was treated fairly, you know, the problem is that for better or worse, for most people, what they see for the vast majority of the time before they vote is the media narrative. And, you know, Frank Ginta is a very well-known individual at this point, having been mayor of Manchester and congressman for the first CD. Dan Innes is, because of his unusual circumstances as a gay married Republican, also the dean of the business school at UNH, also a very kind of interesting figure, got the union leader endorsement. Mr. Kelly is a former selectman from Seabrook, just not well known. And there's only so much that can be done to bring somebody like that into the race. You know, I thought it was tough. We saw a little bit of this in the other CD as well with Jim Lawrence, African-American candidate for Congress. He actually had, I think, a good night. But also they had to kind of keep remembering to go back to him because they got caught up in the back and forth between Garcia and Lambert. Sure, it may not be fair, but it's just kind of the reality of how the process works.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call, Peter. And by the way, if anybody wants to learn more about these candidates, known and less well-known, there's a lot more coverage of politics on our website, nhpr.org, including profiles of the candidates by our digital reporter, Brian Walston, and NHPR's conversations with these candidates. So nhpr.org, there's a lot more coverage there than what we can provide you on the air right now. Go to NHPR.org to find out more. Well, all of you, it's been a big week for Republicans here in New Hampshire, as we've been saying, with these primary debates. But Kathleen Ronan, Joe Biden was here as well, talking at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard.
Yes, he was at the shipyard on Wednesday, and Gene Shaheen and Carol Shea Porter were with him. Annie Custer, I think, had a previously scheduled engagement, and so she was not there. He was there to talk about the importance of the shipyard, talk about creating jobs. But I think the headline that everybody saw from that was his comments about ISIS and how, you know, the U.S. would follow these terrorists to the gates of hell. And I think, as we talked about earlier in the program, you know, there's been a criticism of the Obama administration and maybe they're not tough enough against these terrorists. Obama's "we don't have a strategy" comment has gotten a lot of airtime. Scott Brown's focused on it. So I think it was important for Biden to come out and to make those very strong comments and, you know, to have people like Gene Shaheen and Carol Shea Porter by his side when he did it. That, you know, just the imagery of that, you know, is, I guess, good for them to be there when he's making those strong comments. But on the other side, do they really want to be seen with a possibly unpopular administration this close to the election?
Yeah,
so I think there's positives and negatives. Yeah.
Josh?
Well, I mean, this was an official visit by the vice president. And, you know, the distinction about what's official and what amounts to, you know, politicking is always blurry, and particularly so, you know, when an election comes. And, you know, it's not surprising that you had, you know, Democrats from New Hampshire and Maine. But, you know, Shaheen got the most focus, and, you know, Biden talked up her defense of the shipyard, and, you know, she made a point to suggest that the shipyard, you know, could be in peril again. You know, Biden was immediately like, "You're the best in the world. This isn't, you know, the there's no indication that the BRAC process is going to, you know, start up again and the shipyard will be on the hook." You know, there are a lot of votes at the shipyard. And then Biden hit the town of Portsmouth, you know, had a lobster roll with Carol Shea Porter at the ferry landing. I mean, this was, you know, largely a political visit. I mean, and you know, Democrats, you know, are hoping, you know, certainly Shaheen would be hoping that, you know, my defense of the shipyard, I'm somebody you can trust. I'm not the new person who just arrived. You know, Scott Brown says he was born at the shipyard. He was. You know, the shipyard is a backdrop for a lot of the narratives this fall.
So here's the question, Josh, and maybe I'll ask you and throw it to Dean as well. It was a political visit, as you said. Gene Shaheen, Carol Shea Porter, obviously hoping it will boost them. What about Joe Biden himself? Ken Rudin yesterday, the political junkie, was with me on the air and then speculated that maybe Vice President Biden is also interested in coming to New Hampshire for his own presidential aspirations. Was there any buzz about that?
Well, I mean, who knows? Anytime a vice president would come, there'd be buzz. And every time Biden comes and he's made, you know, a bunch of trips to New Hampshire, there's always buzz. And, you know, we're a ways away. It's certainly not implausible to speculate about a vice president. You know, the man has run twice here before. He didn't do well either time. You know, he wasn't vice president, but, you know, I'm not going to go there, really.
Sure. Dean, do you want to go there?
Sure, I'd be happy to. You know, I think he's probably interested. I think he's done a little bit of the testing of the waters in terms of some fundraising and these occasional visits. The polling in the state right now looks pretty gloomy for him. I think the most recent primary poll on the Democratic side had Hillary Clinton like at 60-some-odd percent, and he was down around 8%. You know, just my sort of casual anecdotal listening and talking to Democrats, not a lot of interest in having him as a presidential candidate, that he sort of has kind of run his course, you know, multiple decades in the Senate and now as vice president, maybe time to retire, kind of a la Dick Cheney. He may flirt with it a bit. He may think about it. But I think it's highly unlikely to materialize at this point.
And one more presidential question for you, Dean. So you talked earlier about Ted Cruz coming up and helping out Marilinda Garcia in the 2nd District. We talked about Joe Biden. Rand Paul is coming next week to the state.
Yeah, I think it's Thursday morning. It's a unity breakfast. Basically, you know, we have these events after every primary to sort of, you know, soothe egos a little bit,
so
kind of unify,
bury,
yeah, all that sort of stuff. And, you know, sometimes former candidates make a statement by not showing up, but typically there's a lot of pressure on them to all make nice. So yet another good platform for Rand Paul, given the 2016 primary.
I mean, not on the presidential level, but RNC Chair Renz Priebus is here today as well. And, you know, this is something that Republicans are trying to, you know, and Bobby Jindal is going to be here too, and tried to stoke what they believe to be an enthusiasm advantage that you know could be meaningful in November. So, you know, the more Republicans can get engaged in the primary, the more likely they are to vote in the general, and you know, presumably that would mean good things up and down the ticket for them. So there's a lot of that going on.
One more story that I did want to ask all of you about that has nothing to do with the primary elections or the far-off presidential election. Kathleen, I turn to you first. The state released a 10-year energy plan this week. What's the impact of this? How's it used?
Yeah, well, this plan was an update to an energy plan that I think was last put out in maybe 2002, sometime around there, so a little more than 10 years ago. And the goal is really to just evaluate, you know, New Hampshire's current, you know, what we're doing on an energy level and see what we should be doing in the future. There's no mandates in it. It's just recommendations about what we could be doing. So, you know, the report talked about diversifying or modernizing the electrical grid so we can support different types of energy. It talked about, you know, energy efficiency. One interesting thing in there is it said that the state has not even come close to fully tapping its wind and solar power. We've seen a lot of controversy over wind power here, but it's interesting in that report that it says that there's a lot more the state could be doing. So no mandates, attempts to kind of lay out a roadmap for if we are, you know, making decisions, energy-related laws, bills in the future. Here are some ideas that we might want to consider. Here are things we might want to look at. But it really, I mean, it doesn't mandate anything.
Yeah, so this is just kind of a broad framework for lawmakers and governors to think about, basically.
Well, some provisions could be implemented by the Public Utilities Commission, but others would take legislative action. You know, one thing was it talked about doing a better job setting like sort of real targets for, you know, energy efficiency programs, keeping better track of those.
We did a program earlier on electric cars, Josh, and one of the big problems in New Hampshire was not enough charging stations.
That was also mentioned.
Yeah, and talking about solar capacity, it was a big increase, they said, New Hampshire could do, Kathleen. You don't have to give us specific numbers, but I was struck by that too. They said there's a lot more solar potential here than what we think of. We're all thinking about, you know, gloomy days in November and March when the sun doesn't
shine. Yeah, and I think compared to other New England states and some of our neighbors, New Hampshire's using solar power far less than some of those other states are. So definitely room to expand there, and hopefully maybe kind of make people rethink solar energy and how it could be applied here in New Hampshire.
Yeah, I took a brief weekend trip over the summer to Vermont, and I hadn't been there in a while, and I was struck by how much solar power there was. It seems like every time I turn my head out the window, there was another big set of solar panels. All right. Well, wrapping up, all of you, I want to let everybody know that, of course, next week we will be looking at the primary results and looking ahead to the general election with the primary on Tuesday. We're also going to talk to the author of a forthcoming book about the New Hampshire lottery turning 50. And then NPR's Brooke Gladstone from On the Media will be joining us. So that's what we're up to. How about you, Josh? What are you going to be watching next week?
We'll see what happens on primary night.
Yeah,
and then,
that's pretty much
you know,
it, right?
Sift through the fallout.
Yeah, yeah. Three big races. Actually, four big races. Go ahead, Kathleen. How about you?
I'll be paying attention on primary night as well. And I think a few potentially interesting races at the state level. We've seen Nancy Stiles and Dave Booten be attacked pretty relentlessly for their support of Medicaid expansion and the gas tax. A lot of mailers from Americans for Prosperity, some other groups. So I'm going to be really interested to see if those votes really were bad news for those two candidates. And I think, you know, they seem in a decent position to withstand their primary challenge, but I'm going to be looking for that and seeing what happens in both of those races.
Well, that's a great point. We've been focusing on the debates, the congressional districts, the U.S. Senate, the governors, but there are some important primaries for the U.S. Senate, especially on the Republican side. Dean Spiliotis, one big primary on the Democratic side.
Yeah, the Senate District 15, this is the Senate seat being vacated by Sylvia Larson, Dan Feltes, Cass Ardinger. It's been quite the big news among Democrats in Concord and Hopkinton, gotten quite nasty. But Kathleen's exactly right. From the U.S. Senate all the way down to state legislature, but a lot of interesting races next week, and I'll be back here next Friday talking about it.
All right. Well, all of you, thank you very much for coming in. Dean Spiliotis, good to see you. Thank you very much.
Sure thing, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the Schools of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. Josh, I know you had a busy night yesterday with the Senate race. I appreciate you joining us today.
Oh, no problem, Laura.
Josh Rogers, senior political reporter for us here at NHPR. And Kathleen Ronayne, it was nice to see you. Thank you also for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Kathleen Ronayne, State House reporter for the Concord Monitor. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producer is Faith Meixel. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Laura Knoy.